doing quantum mechanics and degenerate ground states. And today we'll start at 10,000 feet and do some kind of abstract point of view from a physicist's viewpoint on anomalies and inflow. And then over the next two lectures, we'll try to meet in the middle. Okay, so for this lecture, we'll have a kind of general setting of d-dimensional quantum field theory. Here, d is space-time dimension, so d equals 1 is quantum mechanics. And we have some symmetry structure. And this defines some classical backgrounds. We'll call these background fields A collectively. And these define arguments of the partition function. So we'll denote the partition function as z, and it depends on A. Let me unpack this A for you. There are various kind of types that we might be talking about, types of symmetries. Physicists usually divide them into two camps. The first are so-called internal symmetries. These don't involve space-time in any way. So they could be, for instance, a finite group . It could be a Lie group, compact Lie group. Could be a higher group, etc. And so for all these possibilities, A would be an appropriate notion of a connection. So in operator language, we heard about this from Cantaro. For a finite group, say, or one of these pi finite things, this would be a flat connection A. And studying the theory coupled to this flat connection that is trying to compute this partition function z of A is the same thing as studying a network of symmetry defects. And this arrow is essentially Poincaré duality. For a compact Lie group, we have more information. So then we'll have a not just a flat connection, but a general connection, potentially with curvature. So here, there's both local data which is the same thing as the current correlation functions. We'll talk more about currents in a bit, but you heard a little bit in the previous lecture. And there's also some kind of global data, which is the bundle topology. And just to emphasize a very basic point, we've heard a lot about finite gauge theory in the previous lectures. In that context, connections were dynamical variables and were summed over. For me here, this connection is a classical background field. It's something that is fixed in the partition function. Any questions? Okay, so that's internal symmetry. It doesn't involve space-time. But there are other symmetries that do involve space-time. So we group them into a second category, which we sometimes call space-time symmetries. And okay, I'll make kind of a little dictionary here. There's Lorentz symmetry. And what is the background field associated to that? Well, it's the ability to go on a general manifold. So we could think that it's a metric. So there's local data in the metric, and there's also global data of the topology of the space-time manifold. We could also have a theory with fermions. Then we could say that the symmetry is fermion number, a Z2 grading. And here, we would need a spin structure. Last time, we also talked about theories with time reversal symmetry. What's the right kind of background field for that? Well, the right kind of background field is the first Stiefel-Whitney class. So we can let space-time be unoriented, unorientable. So these are the, given some kind of symmetry, you'll have some appropriate notion of a background field. And I've outlined some of them here. And through this lecture, I'll use A to collectively denote all such backgrounds. So Z of A, the partition function, will depend on all these background fields that we have. And the menu of background fields depends on the symmetry type of the field theory. Questions? So I want to build you up to a kind of classical physicist point of view on what anomalies are and try to connect onto a more modern point of view. And to get there, it's helpful to think about gauge transformations. So that's what we're going to talk about now, and in a sense, for most of the rest of this lecture. So the data of A is often subject to gauge redundancies. So we'll denote this gauge redundancy by saying that we could change A to A superscript lambda, where lambda here is an appropriate kind of gauge parameter. And I will unpack this momentarily. So for connections, this is easy to understand. So this is standard gauge transformations. And it will be useful to have in mind some concrete examples as we proceed through the discussion. So let's imagine, for instance, we were talking about U1 global symmetry. So A would be a standard connection on a U1 bundle then. And then we would just be talking about the freedom to change A locally to A plus d lambda. For finite groups, we would do something simple. We're talking about global symmetries, yes?
Yeah.
Well, sorry, what was the question? No, and I didn't say that it was, I don't think. Well, I mean that the partition function, for instance, is invariant. Yeah. Although, you know, fine print to follow. Yeah, so thank you for the question. Any other questions from the balcony or any other levels of seating? Sorry?
Can you repeat?
What is the connection for supersymmetry?
I don't want to answer this question. let's talk about it after. It might get us into the weeds a little bit. Okay. Okay. So let's keep going. So right. So what I mean by redundancy is that we're going to try and investigate, as we'll see, to what extent the partition function is invariant under these kind of transformations. And that allows, as Tudor was saying, for the fact that the classical action, if you have one, defining your theory, may not be invariant on the nose. Okay, so this was what we should do for, say, U1. What should we do for finite groups? Well, for finite groups, you may have an explicit co-cycle representing your gain, your connection. So we would shift a cocycle by a coboundary. And so so we'd like to understand this these kind of transformations. What do I mean by that? So a kind of key point, key sticking point that one encounters in physics is that in defining Z of A, someone hands you an explicit QFT and you want to compute Z of A explicitly, you typically pick explicit representatives. In other words, for the case of ordinary symmetry, explicit connections. And you use that connection in defining Z of A. And then you have to ask the following question. You have to ask, is Z of A equal to Z of A lambda? I.e., is the partition function gauge invariant? And what kind of, and if not, how badly can we allow it to be non-gauge invariant? So this is the question that we're going to explore today. So we'll give a very long-winded answer to this, but the first point is to notice that gauge invariants of the partition function is closely related to topological invariance of the symmetry defects. So we heard many times that symmetries are topological operators, and here I'm focused on for this discussion, standard invertible group-like symmetries, so invertible topological operators, the easiest thing. And let me show you this. We know that there's some kind of symmetry defect, or we think there is, and we think it's topological. So let's take, our favorite example, symmetry group U1. So let's take a particular element in here. I'll call it e to the I phi. So there should be a codimension 1 defect. I'm talking about ordinary, not higher form global symmetry here. Let's draw the defect. Okay, so we'll imagine that locally we have sliced our space-time manifold in the following way. So here's some coordinate tau. Here's tau equals tau naught, where we have inserted the defect. So this is the codimension 1 defect. And this is described by an equivalent gauge field. We heard that there's a dictionary between symmetry defects and background fields. We can write it very explicitly in this case. So the associated background field for this slice of this defect is just A equals phi times delta of tau minus tau naught d tau. So it's locally a one form. And how did I come up with that formula? Well, it should be localized. The only non-trivial thing that's happening should be at this defect. And we can see what the key property is. We look at this dual line here. So this is a dual Wilson line. And we have the key property that the integral of this A over that line is equal to the group element that we were trying, whose defect we were trying to construct. So for the simplest case of a U1 global symmetry with a standard connection background field, this is the dictionary between symmetry defects and background fields. And circling back to our main question here, I would like you to notice that the defect at a specific location i.e. tau equals tau naught, that this required a choice of connection. So you see explicitly that where we put the defect entered in this formula. How do we move the defect? Suppose we want to move the defect from tau naught to tau 1. This requires a gauge transformation. So the gauge parameter lambda that you would need to do that, if you want to keep it in this kind of delta function localized way, involves a step function. So we could write lambda is equal to phi times step function of tau minus tau 1 minus step function of tau minus tau naught. So I remind all the mathematicians in the audience that delta is the Dirac delta distribution, and this is the Heaviside step function. You can find it on Wikipedia. Okay, so this is an allowed gauge transformation. It has compact support. So it's only non-zero in a little window in the region where we're trying, between tau naught and tau 1, where we're trying to shift this symmetry defect. And I'm using here, of course, that the exterior derivative of the derivative of theta is the delta function. Okay, so we talked a lot about symmetry means topological operators. And now you see that to really, say, check topological invariants, to move the defects, you need to be able to do gauge transformations. So if we contemplate the possibility that z of a is not equal to z of a lambda, we are in fact contemplating some kind of breakdown of topological invariants. Of symmetry defects. Now that sounds scary, because we started by saying we have some symmetry, we thought we had some symmetry defects, and now we're contemplating the fact that they're not in fact topological operators. So we need to understand to what extent do we allow an inequality here. So let's ask, what kind of failure is possible? So a kind of key idea from physics here is the distinction between separated points and coincident points. So the key idea is that as long as the defects are separated, by this I mean the support is not coincident. we expect topological invariance, or we demand, I should say, invariance holds exactly. So the situation where I was talking, where I just have some symmetry defect operating at a constant time, and I shift it a little bit, I'm not worried about that, a breakdown of gauge invariance at that level. After all, that is what I meant by saying that I had the symmetry to begin with. Instead, the allowed kind of failure, the allowed kind of inequality here, should be concentrated only when the defects intersect. Let's draw a little picture just so we're on the same page. So if we were in quantum mechanics, here's the timeline of quantum mechanics. We could have codimension one topological defects. We'll call them G and H. And wiggling G and wiggling H without having them touch each other, we're not worried about that. But what we're worried about is whether this is equal to GH. What happens when they coincide? And note that this is exactly, this equality is exactly what you need to check to see if you have a projective representation. So we're eventually going to make contact with that, though maybe not today. One can continue that discussion into higher dimensions. Let me just draw one more picture. So for instance, in a two-dimensional theory, what would be the generalization of this picture? Well, we could have, one possibility is to have a situation like this, where we have three defects, G, H, and K, and they fuse into their product, G, H, K. And we want to know, is this equal to the analogous picture where I move the leg of K? So, of course, this is the kind of diagram that you need to investigate to see higher group cohomology. So, in particular, for this example, it would be H3. Okay, so we want to allow the possibility the partition function is not exactly gauge invariant, but we want to enforce that it is gauge invariant at separated points. And this motivates a very simple ansatz, which then lets us connect to a more modern point of view on anomalies. Yes, please. Yeah, it's a great question. So the question was, why did I draw the three defects of two dimensions? Why not two dimensions? In part, it is answered by the ansatz. So maybe let me try to answer it in that context by writing an equation. So,
Glenn, I have also a question in the chat. Can I ask?
Yes, please.
So does this characterization also work for one-form symmetries in 3D, where the anomaly doesn't necessarily involve junctions?
Yes. Was there another question?
Is there a simple way to see that there's no issue? Is there a simple way to see that there's no issue that separated points? Or is that just an ansatz that you built in?
That is an assumption that I put in. So, I mean, I would say that's a bit part of the kind of physics philosophy of quantum field theory. So the question was a good one about what's going on at separated points. And in general, I would say, as an answer to that, that what we mean by having a symmetry is that there's no problem at separated points. So, for instance, I'll write it in a minute, but if we have a conserved current, what it means to say that it is conserved is that its divergence is zero as long as it doesn't touch any other operators.
Yeah, great. I guess I could imagine settings where you have some operators, not necessarily associated to a symmetry, but some operators that behave topologically, classically, that might have some quantum.
Yeah, so I would say that if you have that situation, then intrinsically in the quantum theory, you should not call it a symmetry.
Thanks.
Okay, so what's the ansatz? What am I going to try and write? So the ansatz is that I'll allow the partition function of A lambda to not be exactly equal to Z of A, but I'll allow it to differ by a phase. So, okay, notation here, X was space-time. And what's going into this formula? Well, one thing that's going in is that I'm going to put a big restriction on this alpha. I'm going to demand that it's a local functional. Let me emphasize this word, local. In general, that means it obeys some kind of cutting and gluing rules. Why am I putting the constraint that alpha is a local function? So again, if we were in the continuous setting where we have a continuous connection and a continuous gauge parameter, I mean that alpha is something like multiply them all together at one point and integrate, or maybe take derivatives. Okay, so why am I emphasizing that? Well, that's the assumption that there's no problem at separated points. This is where I'm putting in that the only problem is at coincident points. And again, let me try to unpack that in this example.
Clay, one question before you continue.
Yes.
How should we distinguish before separate versus coincide points for space-time symmetry such as time reversal?
How should we consider, say it again?
How can we distinguish between these two types of points for space-time symmetry such as time reversal?
Well, good. So let me answer that for a cousin of the question, which is like Lorentz symmetry. Then in that case, you could probe Lorentz symmetry by insertion of the energy momentum tensor operator. And we would demand that the energy momentum tensor is conserved as long as it is not touching any other operator in the theory. The situation with time reversal is more subtle and actually closely related to the question that was asked last lecture about is there a defect for time reversal symmetry? And again, we can talk about it offline. More questions? Yeah. Okay, so it's helpful. Let's look again. To think at with this U1 example. Okay, so coupling to A, in that case, A is just a standard connection. So coupling to A means just writing, we take the action, whatever it was, this is the action, and we include in here integral of a new term, an integral over space-time of A wedge star J. J here, this is a one-form conserved current. So that's the standard conserved current that is discussed when one has a global symmetry. Star of it is closed, so that's why this is a reasonable thing to do. So what happens when you do a gauge transformation? So this is, in a sense, I'm just writing the answer to Tudor's question again. So we do a gauge transformation which shifts A locally by the exterior derivative of some gauge parameter. And the change in the action, well, we're just going to modify this term, is going to give us an integral over x of d lambda wedge star j, or by integration by parts, an integral over x of lambda wedge d of star j. So d of star j, in a more physicist notation for those physicists in the audience, that's the same thing as the divergence of the current. This vanishes at separated points. What that means, concretely, for instance, is that if you look at a correlation function, Dan talked a little bit about correlation functions, so they're usually indicated by some angle brackets. Where, say, for instance, we put some local operators O at yi and d star j at x, that this is identically equal to zero if x is not equal to any of the yi. This is what I mean by saying that the operator vanishes at separated points. However, we are going to allow contact terms. I.e. terms that are non-zero at coincident points. So if you examine this kind of ansatz, and you think about this term, so think about this term, it means that, for instance, in this simple example, functional derivatives with respect to A are inserting more and more J's. A and J are dual variables. And so that means that taking alpha local is enforcing that the ambiguity or failure in the topological property is only at coincident points. Yes. Does the ABJ anomaly satisfy this condition? That's a subtle question because there was progress on the ABJ anomaly in the last month. So prior to that progress, I would have said the answer is no. The ABJ anomaly, the divergence of the current, is non-zero at separated points. Yeah, so it does not satisfy this property. This is a bit similar to the question that Tudor asked a little while ago, where what if you have a situation where classically it looks like there's a symmetry, but in fact, quantum mechanically, there is not. What that means in this language is that classically it looks like you have a topological operator, but quantum mechanically you do not, and you do not even at separated points.
Sorry, one question. This correlator is computed with a equals zero or not?
This one here?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I was talking about at a equals zero.
Okay.
Sorry, thank you. So another question you might ask is, why in this ansatz do I have why have I enforced the condition that the ambiguity is only in the phase? This is related to the question that was asked previously about can there be something, say, at only when defects intersect in codimension 2 in 2 dimensions. So why this? Well, in general, the partition function, this has an answer that's similar to what we saw in quantum mechanics. So the partition function, the modulus, has a probability interpretation. So I'd like to maintain that. So this is analogous to the kind of ray situation in quantum mechanics. Where the norm of the state has a probabilistic interpretation. Okay, so we're going to contemplate the possibility, or allow, that the partition function has this kind of phase ambiguity under gauge transformations. And I'd like to, so this is kind of the traditional point of view on anomalies, but I'd like to now connect onto more modern ideas. So let's try to do that. So this an important point is that the partition function Z of A is subject to an ambiguity. So the ambiguity is that you could try to modify the partition function in its phase by a local function. I'll write it like this, schematically. So here again, beta is local. What are we doing with this? Well, this is the freedom to try to change scheme, what physicists call a scheme change. So sometimes you may have heard physicists refer to fixing a scheme or changing a scheme. What they mean is nailing down the partition function, even including its base. So picking an explicit slice there. So we have two things on the board. We have this kind of phase ambiguity under gauge transformations. And we have this possibility to try to modify the partition function to try to remove it. So this leads to a kind of cohomology problem. Where you look at the set of possible alphas, modulo the equivalence relation that alpha is identified with alpha plus the variation of beta. And this is the kind of old-fashioned definition of possible anomalies. So given a fixed symmetry type in a fixed dimension, you could try to investigate all the possible anomalies in this way. What does it have to do with more modern notions? Well, let's now get there. So we now get to kind of the main point. I'll call it inflow. And depending on who you ask, anomaly inflow is a hypothesis or a definition or maybe even a non-trivial theorem. And I won't take a point of view on that. So what is the statement here? So we've gone in this long dance about contemplating gauge variation of the partition function. And we'd like to know, how can we capture these equivalence classes? And what is the statement here? Yes. Yes.
So can I say that anomalies can be equivalently classified by the counterterms?
Can you say that anomalies can be classified by counterterms? No, I would not say that. I would say that, so the counterterms are here.
No, I mean the counterterms that you erased for the local correlation functions.
The counterterms for, no, because this is moving the counterterms for local correlation functions. Right? So it's kind of contact terms that you can't remove.
Mm-hmm. And also, why does that explain the previous question that the modulus of Z doesn't change explain? And I thought previously the question is asking for 1 plus 1 dq of t.
So that question, so here, this ambiguity is just in the phase. And you might have imagined that I inserted, say, a non-trivial operator here, not a multiple of the identity operator. And then that's what would have happened if we followed through on that suggestion in two dimensions. And then that would have broken this.
I thought the question is asking, suppose I have a defect G and defect H.
And then you'll have to insert a non-trivial operator in two dimensions at their intersection. To get a phase, you have to go lower down.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so let me get to this main statement. What's this statement? So for any anomaly, alpha, there is a d plus 1 dimensional invertible theory . So the word invertible has many avatars depending on what community you're in, so let me also sometimes people call it a classical theory to indicate that nothing fluctuates. Sometimes people call it an SPT if you're from the condensed matter community. All of those are roughly synonyms. So what is the property of this invertible theory? So first of all, I'll write its partition function. So the partition function looks like so, e to the 2 pi I y. So y here is a d plus 1 manifold. And A is the same kind of background fields, but now extended into one higher dimension. So this omega is like the Lagrangian of the invertible theory. And what's the property? Such that what? The following formula holds. So if boundary of y is equal to x, our space-time, then can express the anomalous phase, this thing alpha, as follows. So that's the key formula. It may be helpful to draw a geometric picture to understand what is being stated by this formula. An invertible theory in D plus one dimensions is something we can evaluate on a closed D plus one manifold. So let's make a closed D plus one manifold. So we'll take the D plus one manifold to be a mapping torus. I'll denote it like this. So it's a mapping torus for lambda. What do I mean by that? Well, so let's try to draw. Okay, we have some. This will be x. We'll propagate x for a little while through time, through some extra dimension. Supposed to look the same, but apologies. So this is again x over here. Let's call this direction t, and this will be t initial, and this will be t final. Okay, we'll call the fields here a tilde, and on this side at t initial, a tilde restricted to t initial is a. And on this side, at t final, a tilde restricted to t final is a lambda. And we're gluing t initial to t final to make this mapping torus manifold. Okay, so once you have that mapping torus, then you can give a kind of intrinsic meaning to this inflow formula for the anomalous phase. Which is that, so this anomalous phase, which is usually found in the kind of older literature discussing anomalies, so that was this quantity. This is then equal to the partition function of the invertible theory evaluated on the mapping torus. So inflow then allows us, because of this formula, inflow allows us to, or this point of view on this anomalous phase in terms of an invertible theory in one higher dimension, allows us to construct, in a sense, a more satisfactory partition function. So this allows us to define a modified but fully gauge invariant partition function . So what is it? Z tilde of A. Okay, it's Z of A. And then we dress it with this invertible theory. So here, the boundary of Y is equal to X. And then by construction, Z tilde of A lambda is equal to Z tilde of A. So we have got a new partition function, Z tilde, which is exactly gauge invariant. But the price we have paid is that our theory is now the boundary of an invertible theory, our initial theory that we started with. Then we imagine that X is a component of the boundary of Y. And that part is always possible. See Dan's lecture. Well, let me just write the last sentence, and then I'll take many questions. Okay, so I'll conclude now, and just to say that kind of the paradigm that we've arrived at is that an anomalous field theory is a boundary of an invertible field theory. And in a sense, a more modern definition and starting point, but I wanted to connect onto older points of view on anomalies, is that you could say that anomalies maybe could be defined by invertible theories. And which point of view you prefer depends a little bit on the starting point of your problem. So often in physics, we are presented with a QFT, and we wish to compute its anomaly. So we don't know yet what the one higher dimensional theory is. That's part of the problem, is to figure that out. And conversely, sometimes in condensed matter physics or in mathematics, you might be given the invertible theory, and you want to know what lives on the boundary. So which point of view you prefer kind of depends on your starting initial data. Okay, so I'll stop here and take some questions.
Thank you. So what is the Bok invertible theory for the trace anomaly for conformal field theory?
That question does not have a very good answer. Yeah, so I sort of stayed away from conformal symmetry. Part of the reason it's sort of hard to, I think, to do this paradigm for conformal symmetry is that the nature of the conformal group can jump between dimensions. So I don't have a good answer to that question.
I have a question from the chat, Clay.
Yeah.
Can the Balkan boundary have different tangential structures? Say one is a spin and the other is non-spin?
Usually we take them to be the same. If they're not the same, some kind of symmetry breaking is happening. Maybe spontaneous, but some kind of symmetry breaking.
So you wanted to quotient out by these betas, right? The d betas. So are you saying that you want to get rid of invertible symmetry, like tensoring with invertible symmetries doesn't do anything for the theory itself?
No, that is indeed a part of the removing the betas. Invertible theories in the given dimension are interesting, but they don't modify the correlation functions at separated points. So in a sense, when a field theorist defines QFT, they don't mean with a choice of scheme. I mean, it depends a little bit on the language, but you and I may be talking about the same field theory, but we might differ in our choice of scheme, which means we've differed, say, in the choice of betas. So we'd like to allow for that change.
So to understand quantum field theory in dimension D, it is not very interesting to understand invertible field theories in dimension D, but only to understand invertible field theories in dimension D plus one, because you want to understand anomalies?
Well, certainly for anomalies, that's the case, yeah.
All right, thanks.
Is the anomaly field theory always really a field theory? Because if you, for example, take the anomaly in dimension 4 associated to H5 of SUM.
Can you speak into the mic?
I am speaking into the mic, but it's not picking me up. I take off my mask. If we take the anomaly in dimension 4 associated to H5 of SUN, now the bulk theory seems like it should be Chern-Simons for the Chern-Simons 5 form. It's not really a theory. It's just a functional of a connection. So is it? Do you understand my complaint?
Well, I guess I would say that isn't the Chern-Simons 5 form an invertible theory? It doesn't have to make sense to sum over that connection. It doesn't have to be a good starting point for summation. I don't think it is in that case. But it is a fine classical functional that obeys all cutting and gluing axioms.
I'm fine with it being a classical functional, but I'm not sure I would be happy taking any functional of a field and saying that defines a quantum field theory. I don't think that's the right terminology. I mean, there's no, all the OPEs are trivial, you know.
Well, but
all the correlation functions are zero.
Well, every invertible theory has vanishing correlation functions except for at coincident points. It's sort of just a theory of contact terms. That's kind of what an invertible field theory is.
I think you would agree that just writing down the Chern-Simons Lagrangian is not enough to give you a five-dimensional invertible theory, because there's no kinetic term. You must do something else.
Now, why do you need the kinetic? I don't think you need the kinetic term for the invertible field. I think the Chern-Simons term does satisfy the. I mean, we have Dan in the audience. He can answer us. But Dan, would you say the 5D Chern-Simons theory, local Chern-Simons functional A D A D A, with appropriate coefficient, is an invertible 5D theory? Say U1 or SUN.
Yeah, I mean, but the background field is orientation.
I suppose I still don't understand what it means to take that Lagrangian and build a theory then.
Let's talk more.
Yeah, you have the sentence, this is an invertible theory, and that sentence just doesn't parse for me.
I just meant that it's partition function. For me, that, for instance, means that its partition function has unit modulus. there's a question down here.
Maybe it's a related question. How should I think about the Z of the invertible theory? Is like the partition function, or is like e to the is, and I do not integrate over the field A? Is it really A is?
Is A like is the background field. So nothing. I mean, it's e. You know, the partition function of an invertible theory has modulus one. Always.
Okay, so maybe this is the reason why it's not necessary to have the kinetic term, because it's not the action. It's like the output of something. It's really the partition function.
It's a partition function, but in a sense, it's like a classical theory, because in a sense, nothing is summed over. That's why sometimes people use the word classical to talk when they talk about invertible theories.
Okay.
Do we assume that the theory in the bulk to be topological or it's arbitrary?
The answer to that depends a little bit on what you mean. In a strict sense, I think the answer is no. For instance, I think in a strict sense, the Chern-Simons example is not exactly topological.
So there are some questions in the chat, Clay.
Yeah.
What is the anomaly alpha lambda a corresponding to an SPT given by Borde-Sim invariant, which is not detectable on a mapping torus?
Yeah, that's a great question. Someone has caught the loophole. So indeed, not every SPT. There are some fancier invertible theories that cannot be detected on a mapping torus. And nevertheless, it seems that they correspond to interesting anomalies of quantum field theories that have all the power that I'll tell you about next time. So in a sense, the kind of physicist starting point where I motivated this mapping torus does not actually give you the most general point of view. So it is limited in that sense. And that is why it is maybe better to start here, at least to capture all of those examples as well. But I wanted to connect onto the older reasoning of gauge non-invariance. So thanks for the question, whoever that was.
Another question here from the chat. Is this an example of the general construction presented in Dan's lecture, where the original theory is like a regular module of some topological field theory of one dimension higher?
Yeah, I think I'm talking about a special case of that, yes. Seems I've left everybody in a state of confusion, which is good. So we'll pick up again in a couple days. Thank you.